Sound of Hockey episode 109. We're calling this one the Doc Emmerich episode. Why are we calling it that, John?
It's because Doc Emmerich, the voice of NHL on NBC, is retiring after 47 years in the biz.
And he had 109 verbs.
That's a pretty long time. Yeah, he's been waffle-boarded away, as they say. I mean, the guy is a legend, right? It's a pretty big deal. I know that sometimes we joked about some of his antics, but I mean, you can't get around what he's done for the sport. And you think about any big moment in hockey over, at least over the past decade, 15, 20 years, it seems to have been called by Doc. So huge thing, huge legend of the game, stepping aside. Good for him. Congratulations. I'm sure you're listening, Doc. Yes.
Can I tell you guys, I don't think I've ever shared the story about me meeting him in New York.
No, right? But I'd love to hear it.
So it was back in 2008. I was in New York for about 5 days. And we're going to see 3 games in 3 nights. Long Island, the Devils, and then the Rangers. And I was up at like 6:30 or 7 a.m. on a Saturday in New York. And I went down to Rockefeller Center to get coffee. And lo and behold, right behind me waiting in the line, there's like 8 people in line. It's Doc Emmerich. I'm like, are you doing a game today? And he's like, well, it's actually for tomorrow, but we're doing production meetings today, so, because it's in the NBC building. So I said, oh, I'm from Seattle, I'm just taking in a couple games. And his eyes lit up. He was talking to me the whole time we were waiting in line, grabbed our coffee, and he like stayed around to talk to me. Like, the guy is so passionate and so nice. It was an incredible moment, and I was like, that guy's got a heart of gold. And I've always had a very positive feeling about Doc and his enthusiasm for the sport. So I wishing him well. Going to be interesting to replace him, though.
What was his order?
That I don't know.
Oh, man.
That's a great follow-up. Great, great follow-up. I wanted to comment, I've always found it hilarious how he comes up with these bizarre verbs to describe the play, which I think it's a talent. I mean, it's pretty impressive. You could tell he put a lot of work into improving his vocabulary over the years. Somebody tweeted out a list of their favorites. They are as follows: spirits it, slides it, fiddles it, rattles it, forks it, shovels it, chipped it, poked it, jammed it, ricochets, knifed, tapped, skipped, banks through, punched, pushes, flipped, dragging, soccered, passed, paddled, fires, blasted, speared, steered, scales, leads, rifled, careened, directed, hoisted, pitched, popped, swatted, finesses, wanded, bangs, handed, forces, swiping, plunged, lobbed, nudges, jabbed, drubbed, brushed, wedging, squibbed, stashed. There you go.
You done? That's it?
I'm done. Yeah, that's the whole list.
Yeah. Who do you think replaces him?
I think he's irreplaceable. I don't know. Like, you mean as the number one guy?
Yeah.
Good question. I wonder if they is the guy from Carolina still out
yep.
there?
Yep. Forsland. Yes, yeah, that's who I would he was pretty put good. Money on because I like
he's
him.
Pretty good. Yeah. Kenny Albert got a lot of play for them this last couple of years too, though, so he could also be the guy, whether you like him or not, but he could be a guy.
And then Brendan Burke but he's doing the Islanders full time, so mm-hmm. But Brendan Burke is really good.
But didn't Doc Emmerich wasn't he still doing the Devils full-time while also doing the NBC games? So it could be possible that they get somebody who's already got a gig somewhere else.
That's true, Andy. Very insightful, yeah. Andy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Certainly not over the last, like, couple of years.
No, but yeah, for a long time, I think he was still the main Devils guy.
Anyway, Doc Emmerich, congratulations. Again, sure you're listening. Big fan of the show, we know. This is Sound of Hockey. I'm Darren Brown, at Darren Fun Brown on the Twitter, joined as always by Andy Ide. Hello, Andy.
How's it going? I'm at Andy Ide on the Twitter.
And John Barr. Hello, John.
Hello, everybody. I'm NHL2 Seattle on the Twitter.
And we are coming to you from Seattle. We have a big show today, which will largely be filled up with our very awesome interview with the Brain Trust. Well, part of the Brain Trust, I guess you could say. Two-thirds of the Brain Trust? How much of the Brain Trust?
It's like the frontal lobe
episode?
Of the Brain Trust,
I think,
maybe.
Okay. I think unique individuals, it's two-thirds, but I think they actually have a lot more influence. So I'm saying 80 to 90%.
Whoa. Of the Brain Trust.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Okay, so Namita Nandakumar and Danny Chu of the Seattle Kraken, they make up a significant portion, we'll say a significant portion of the analytics department for that squad. So lots of interesting stuff there. It's kind of comical because they can't really talk about stuff that's super specific. Like, they certainly can't talk about individual players. So of course I tried to pull some tricks to get them to, but they didn't fall for it. But anyway, it's going to be a good interview. Stick around for that. We also have a review to share with you. This comes from Al Robbins. It's a 5-star review. It says, not just a pretty podcast. The guys of this pod were by far the best Crap Weasel podcast ever to exist. On that point, there can be no doubt. But only time will tell if they can capture the same high marks as a Kraken podcast. I believe they can if they remove slash change some of the dead weight segments that seem to detract from the enjoyment of the listeners and sometimes the co-hosts. It's not that we shouldn't be enamored with the gear that the Netminders wear, but it should be more inclusive, like the Seattle franchise is modeling, and be called Hockey Gear Corner.
Ooh, okay. Fair. Ooh, that's interesting feedback.
Yeah. I know. Any mention of fandom for a team from a different state slash province should be avoided at all costs, even if that state does have a bunch of lakes that they are so dang proud of.
Yeah, I like that. On the I like this review. This review is really good.
On the positive side, the sound effects are top-notch for weekly one-timers. It would be cool to have that as a ringtone or maybe as the Kraken goal sound when the PA guy gives the goal and assist announcements.
Who is this? Wow. This is awesome.
Now please get off my lawn. Okay. I feel personally attacked. I don't know if I should.
I think you should.
I don't know why. Okay. It felt perfectly normal.
Well, he called out Goalie Gear Corner and Minutia. He specifically
Hockey Gear Corner, Hockey Gear Corner. And he didn't say Minutia. He just said any state or province that has a lot of lakes.
But he especially one with all the lakes they're proud of.
Mm-hmm.
That's my all-time. I might print that out and put it on my wall.
Pumps Jaws tires then about the weekly one-timer sound effect. Can you imagine that booming over the PA at the Pledge Arena there?
Oh, no.
Mm. Scoring for the Kraken, TJ Oshie.
I'm all for it.
It's very similar to San Jose Sharks. Bam, bam. Right?
Who do we got to call to make that a thing?
I think we know who to call.
Yeah. I think he was on the podcast. Right?
Friend of the pod, yeah. All right, seriously, let's get into our show. First off, we have some new content on NHLToSeattle.com. What do we have, John?
So, Andy, you posted a story on coaches. You want to kind of give us some insight on what that was?
Well, we don't know who the Kraken coach is going to be. Everyone speculates that it's going to be somebody with experience or maybe even a Stanley Cup in their resume. And so I took a look at whether that is the only way to go. And to be honest, it's hard to say because there are more coaches. I think there's 20 current coaches who have been coaches before their current team. So obviously there's a bigger pool there, so some of them have had more success. But that doesn't mean that a first-time coach can't have success. See John Cooper, who is a first-time NHL coach and has won the Stanley Cup just recently and been to two Stanley Cup finals with the Tampa Bay. So I just took a look at some of the history, some of the numbers, and what the past performances are. You know, everybody wants to hire a guy who's already won a Stanley Cup, but there's only been one coach in the modern era who's won a Stanley Cup with two different franchises, and that's Scotty Bowman, and he's not available. So that's not necessarily a done deal if you hire a guy like that. But I just want to take a look at it. It was interesting. I think... I don't know that there's really a conclusion, but I just wanted to kind of lay it out there and let people make up their own minds about what they think the team should do.
Okay, but what's your conclusion?
I'm kind of torn. My conclusion is that it really depends on two things. It depends on the players, because if you're a great coach, you have to have the players, or you know, you can maybe squeeze some wins out of a roster, but to really have success, you need some players. So that's the
really?
First thing.
Well, come on, yeah. Andy.
Imagine that. Imagine
really
that.
Going out on a limb
and
there.
Then as far, I'm not against an inexperienced coach or a first-time NHL head coach. If Ron Francis thinks that the guy they find can you know get these players to mesh, these new players who've not played together before, then by all means hire him. It doesn't mean they're not going to win just because he hasn't been an NHL coach before. So if there's a hot college coach or a really strong junior coach or AHL coach, I'm not against that.
All right, neat. John, you had a thing on free agency as well, right?
Yeah, because free agency this year has been a little weird because not just the timing, but also the flat cap and people are under the cap crunch. It's really had an impact on kind of the cap hits and the terms that players are signing for. So I did a little analysis, and hopefully there'll be a nice little viz that you can go up there and play around and look at different teams and what they did compared to previous years. It's pretty interesting to me, the AAV, which is the annual average value of the contract, which is commonly referred to as the cap hit, that was down 15% year over year with the same number of days in the free agency. So, but that's kind of expected, but it's interesting to put that kind of with the actual numbers.
Very interesting. And speaking of free agent signings and AAV, There were some more signings over the past week. Obviously, we spent most of our episode last week talking about all the signings that had happened. Some of the people that were left out there, though, were Taylor Hall and Alex Pietrangelo, among others. Taylor Hall goes 1 year for $8 million to the Buffalo Sabres, just as we all expected.
A couple things here that I like Buffalo that. Is the only team willing to go to $8 million, or at least that's how it's being reported. And it also, you know, because of the salary cap crunch, he can basically do a short-term deal and play with maybe Jack Eichel, boost his numbers, and all of a sudden he looks better than he did this summer. So I actually like it. At first I was head scratcher, but I actually like it.
Yeah, okay. I like it. I like it for both sides of this. I like it for Buffalo. You know, they could be a decent team this year. I think their defense still is a little shaky, but they'll have a pretty good top six with Hall playing with Eichel. And Taylor Hall also wanted to play. He enjoyed playing for the coach Kruger when he was in Edmonton. And so they'll be reunited, and it could turn into a lucrative deal for him, or maybe he enjoys Buffalo. Maybe they go into the playoffs and he stays there. I think there's a lot of different options there. If he's terrible, then Buffalo, or they're terrible, Buffalo could still move him, I think, at the deadline. So there's a lot of things that are going to happen there, but I think for both sides, it's a positive move.
Yep. I didn't see anybody saying this, but I feel like it also kind of appeases Jack Eichel, who's been pretty vocal about wanting the team to turn around. Obviously, I mean, signing one guy isn't going to change everything, and especially signing him on a one-year deal, but bringing somebody in with real skill and somebody who's been proven to be, you know, one of the best players in the NHL, at least it sends a signal to your superstar that, hey, we're trying to bring you some help here. So I get why they did it. I get why Taylor Hall, well, I kind of get why Taylor Hall did it. It feels feels a little like he's just going after the biggest number, which is odd because he said that he wanted to find a team that would help him win or whatever. But nonetheless, one-year deal so he can go wherever he wants next year. And then Alex Pietrangelo, who was arguably the biggest fish in the pond, signs for 7 years, $8.8 million in Vegas. So that's a total of $61.6 million, and that's a lot of millions of dollars.
Yeah, Vegas going for it all, right?
Yeah.
But you add a player like that to an already deep team, you know, but it's interesting that they did that because I don't know that the defense was their problem last year. You know, I think in the playoffs they couldn't finish, but maybe he helps in that regard too because he is an offensive defenseman.
Tyler Toffoli, 4 years in Montreal, $4.25 million per year. Seems like a decent deal for, I mean, both sides really. You know, Toffoli kind of, I mean, he gets paid, but decent cap hit there for Montreal for a guy that can put the puck in the net.
Yeah, it stinks for the Canucks, who lost him. I would like to see him stay in Vancouver.
Hey, we don't comment on our hometown teams anymore, Andy.
No, only if they have a lot of lakes. Only if they have a lot of lakes.
British Columbia is not known for its lakes.
Okay, sure. Patrick Marleau, back to San Jose, 1 year, $700K. What a bizarre kind of journey this has been for him. So we remember he got traded to Pittsburgh at the deadline. Now he's back in San Jose for his third stint. He has 45 games from tying Gordie Howe's NHL games played record, which is fascinating as well.
Yeah, I don't think I realized he was that close. When you think of games played, you think Gordie Howe's, no one's ever going to touch that. I didn't realize he was that close, but remember that Marleau went straight to the NHL after being drafted, so he's since 18 years old.
And
he's been playing NHL.
He had like the Robo streak, right, where he didn't miss a game for like, yeah. I think he still has it, actually, now that I think about it. You know, there's actually three other people between him and Gordie Howe.
That's true.
Messier, Yager, and Ron Francis. Yep. So that's probably why it feels like he's further away from Gordie Howe.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing, too, is that Gordie Howe played how many seasons in the WHA after he left the NHL, right? So he kept playing and playing and playing even after he left the NHL. But nonetheless, that's a big milestone he's approaching. And speaking of old men that used to play for the San Jose Sharks and may or may not have returned or whatever, I don't know, that's a weird segue. But Joe Thornton, he signs with the Leafs, also 1 year, $700K. What are your thoughts on this, John? Are you sad to see Jumbo go? Not that we're commenting on our own teams that we
like. Well, there's not a lot of lakes. It's the Bay, San Francisco Bay.
Oh, okay.
I'm not really bummed or anything about it. I mean, I love Joe Thornton, but like he's clearly slowed down. And last year there was moments where he looked pretty slow. So I'm not. I don't really. I'm like, oh, great. If that gets him a cup, but, you know, and he's from Ontario, so I think that makes sense. I don't think he adds that much value, but I did get a lot of text messages from Leafs fans commenting about Thornton, and I'm like, oh, okay, fine. Marleau's a better player, there's no doubt, but Thornton is unique and brings a lot of that locker room atmosphere that maybe the Leafs need. At least that's how it's reported in the news or in the media.
Very good. And then our last signing that we're going to comment on, Evgeny Dadonov, goes to Ottawa. 3 years, $5 million per year. Now, he's a guy that really has flown under the radar for me because he's in Florida. So
yeah, I wonder why.
Watches Florida. He flies under everyone's radar, I guess. Yep. But he's got pretty good stats. He had 28 goals two seasons, and this past season he had 26 goals, and that's in a shortened season. So he's going to produce. Ottawa has made some really, really great moves this past year.
Yeah, they've had a good offseason. They had a good draft where they had three first-rounders. So they're a team to kind of keep an eye on. That could be interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if this is the big year they're going to make a step forward, but I think it's coming.
It's coming. Yep, I would agree.
Do you foresee, John, Evgeny Dadonov being protected?
I would assume he's protected because a lot of their young guys are exempt from being drafted, so they don't need to be protected. So he probably will be protected.
Yep, and then finally, different transaction, not so much a signing, but a trade. Nate Schmidt has been traded to Vancouver, obviously a victim of the salary cap crunch that Vegas is under there. But, I mean, I think he's going to be a pretty good fit for the Canucks as well.
Yeah, I like that trade for Vancouver. They needed a defenseman. For starters, they only had five NHL defensemen under contract, so now they have six. But beyond that, he's a really good defenseman, and I think they had Quinn Hughes, but they had no other kind of puck-moving defenseman on the roster, so that'll be a big addition.
You don't think they gave up too much, a third-round draft pick for a top four defenseman in the league?
I'm good with that. I'm good with that.
They basically gave him away, right? Like it's
they had
crazy.
To because by signing Pietrangelo, they were over the cap.
We're going to move on to our interview with Namita and Danny. Just one quick note on that: we actually recorded this one several weeks ago, so if anything feels a little dated, that's the reason we intentionally held on this, because we knew that there was free agency and there was draft and all that stuff that we wanted to make sure we fully covered. So, good interview here. Here it is: Namita Nandukumar and Danny Chu. We now welcome onto Sound of Hockey not one, but two brilliant analytical minds who are currently helping to build the Seattle Kraken roster through their analytics department. She is the senior quantitative analyst and was previously a quantitative analyst for the Philadelphia Eagles. He's the quantitative analyst and previously consulted for the NFL and interned for the NBA. Namita Nandukumar and Danny Chu, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to the show.
For having us.
Thank you.
So, Namita, I'm going to start with you. So, we know that you're a self-described and long-suffering Flyers fan. So, now that you work for a team that will be competing against them starting next year, obviously, how do you anticipate balancing that fandom?
Well, my rule is that once you start sending me paychecks, you are my number one. absolutely no conflict there. And in fact, you know, as with every other team, I'm very excited to sort of evaluate all the players in advance of the expansion draft. Like, I find it really exciting that we're going to be able to select a player from every team, including my former favorite one. So there you go.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a tendency amongst fans to kind of like value your own players so much higher, right? Like the team that I talk about on this podcast, like they're the greatest players, and John's like, I don't think he's that
confirmed.
Good. And I'm like, I don't know. It's the only team that I really watch. So let's be honest here. But so how's this transition been for you? Though I think you're still on the East Coast, am I right?
I am. So I'm still in the Philly area, hoping to move out to Seattle early next year. But, you know, everything's up in the air. But what I think is really great is that our team has managed to be, you know, pretty productive in spite of everything that's going on. And we're coming up with some cool stuff and a lot of Zoom meetings. But that's how life is nowadays. And still pretty excited. And I would say that, you know, this work has definitely been like a bright spot for me, you know, in contrast with like everything else that's going on in the world. So,
And I know that you went to school at Wharton at UPenn. I actually had a very close friend who just finished doing business school there. And he talked about the school weirdly having a great hockey culture. And he played on the club team and claims that he's like a big man on campus because of that. Can you confirm or deny that?
I will say that I never managed to make it out to a club hockey. I would not say anything against your friend.
All right. Well, that's good. I'm going to use this against him now, so I'm happy to hear that. I've been arguing it for a long time. There's no way that being on the club hockey team makes him like some sort of star on campus, but now I have proof. So that's great. And then Danny, I know that your history indicates that although you're Canadian, you actually are a pretty big basketball guy. So how did you end up landing with the Kraken?
Yeah, no, I never thought that I would be turning down a job in basketball. I never thought I'd be offered a job in basketball, and then I never thought that I would be turning down a job in basketball to join hockey. But the Kraken is just such an incredible organization, and Alex and Ron and Todd and the whole crew are just incredible, and made a convincing argument to come join the Kraken and build a hockey team from scratch. So I couldn't really say no to that. So that's kind of how I got here.
Yeah. How do you kind of compare working in basketball versus working in hockey?
Yeah, there's a lot that you can borrow between the two sports. And I think that's something that is true in a lot of analytics roles, is that you can borrow from other fields. And so there's a lot of similarities between basketball and hockey. And so basketball's had tracking data for much longer than hockey has. Hockey's getting it hopefully next season. And so there's going to be lots that we can learn from basketball on that end. And, you know, just having five players on the court for each team, trying to prevent the other team from scoring, they're kind of, the end-to-end play is kind of similar. So, yeah, there's lots to learn from both sports.
I have a similar question for Namita. Obviously, you worked in the NFL, which is vastly different, I would think, than hockey. For those of us who aren't versed in football metrics or football analysis, what are some of the key metrics that you look at when you're evaluating NFL stuff?
I mean, that is a very multifaceted question, because as you're kind of alluding to, it's so complicated. I think in terms of the sort of building block stat that you'll see a lot of people have different versions of is expected points and expected points added, which is just trying to quantify the value of being in a specific sort of situation, whether it's like field position, down distance, so on and so forth. And trying to quantify how much value you're adding with the play after every play. So that's kind of the building block stat. And you can see a lot of sort of stats being built off of that, like looking at quarterback's EPA per attempt. You can also do fun stuff like try to assess the completion probability of every pass, which is very cool. Frankly, I will say that like I worked on a lot of sort of defensive metrics when I was at the Eagles, and that data just is not available to the public, which is why you don't see as much of that sort of exploration publicly. But what I think is really cool is that Mike Lopez, who's the NFL director of analytics, does try to make some of that sort of higher level data, such as tracking data, available publicly through yearly competitions like the Big Data Bowl. And so then you can start to see, I think, some of that cool sort of types of research that I got the opportunity to work on for the past 2 years. So a lot of different things in football analytics. And, you know, it is kind of tricky to sometimes have the data that you need to sort of assess something. Especially when it comes to like trying to assess, you know, linebackers or a position where you might not have sort of traditional stats that are as helpful. No, it's a fun sport to evaluate, very different from hockey, but I'm certainly happy to be in hockey. And there's still a lot of stuff, I think, as Danny was alluding to, just the general process of sort of performing statistical research in sports that you really want to try to borrow from other sports if you can, for sure.
Yeah, we're 2 weeks into the season. I was going to ask, how is your fantasy team doing this year so far?
This is the first time that I'm playing fantasy football, and I'm obsessed with it. The 2 years that I spent with the Eagles, a lot of people upon learning my job would ask me, like, do I have any input on their fantasy team? Like that's such a question, like, shut up. And like more real answer as well is the fact that like, a lot of times analysts across sports, you're really concerned with like the efficiency of players. So what they're doing, you know, given the opportunity that they have. So like if a receiver is only getting two targets, but he's being really productive with those two or three targets, and then you're sort of advocating like, okay, we should target him more. Like that's something that you might do at a team. Right. But in fantasy, you're just trying to figure out who's even gonna get the targets. That's the whole thing in and of itself. And I used to think it was so boring. And now that I have a fantasy team, I'm just every day Googling stuff about Jamison Crowder. So I am like completely on the other end of like, I need to know who's getting what targets and the points and all of that. I'm 1-1 on the year. We have
right, not bad.
Danny's in one of the work leagues. I'm in the other one. I'm doing okay. I think my all-star at this point is Terry McLaurin, who is like the only good player on Washington.
Yeah, scary Terry. My early downfall so far is that I drafted Rob Gronkowski in like the fifth round and he's got two total points, so it's been rough for me.
We begin and start almost every work meeting with a brief fantasy football chat between Namita and I before we have to start work.
We get on the Zoom like 2 minutes early, we're immediately like, oh my god, what's going on with your fantasy team? And then like Alex, our lovely boss, who puts up with so much, will hop on the call and we'll be like, I assume this was hockey. And we're like, oh yeah, no, for sure.
That's awesome.
So speaking of your boss, Namita, wanted me to ask you, how do you like your boss?
Great question. She's awesome. And I think, you know, one of the things that I really like about Alex, in addition to being just like tremendously competent in basically everything that you have to know in order to run an analytics department. So, you know, it's stuff like knowing the types of models that me and Danny are building, but it's also the stuff that I think a lot fewer people think about, like, you know, what are the sort of database infrastructures that you need? And what are the sort of platforms that we want to build for our whole hockey ops team? And that's where our developer and data engineer, Eric and John, come in as well. So it's really, there's so much more in addition to what me and Danny do. And I mean, she's just so well-versed in all of it. It's really impressive. And then in addition to that, I think, you know, she... I don't know, like she just always has really great feedback on everything, and it really helps us do our jobs better. So that's all of my sort of.
I'll add on to the, because she's an absolute all star.
Well, hold on, Danny. She didn't. Hold on. Your boss didn't ask me to ask you, so.
she already knows I love her, so like no, but I mean, like she's got like the technical side, like Amita said, she's got the modeling side to help us. But then she's got like the vision for the team, just the great kind of conversations with Ron and working with people on the hockey side, the contracts and CBA, like she's got all that figured out. Like she's an absolute all-star. She has every single facet that you could want. And then she's just like kind of fun and funny and like good to talk to too, like that just personable communication side. So like she just hits all the boxes and is just fantastic to work for and work with.
Danny and I signed contracts. Like we don't have to be nice. It's nice. We just think she's great. Yeah.
I remember her saying that she looks for people that can pass the beer test, like somebody you'd want to have a beer with. So I think that's definitely true of her as well. She is a friend of the pod. We've had her on the podcast. She was one of our early podcast guests, actually. But I know we kind of want to talk a little bit about like the technology and tools you guys are using right now. Has things changed a little bit in terms of like how you're watching hockey in this world?
I guess the interesting thing is how it hasn't changed, in that like I'm still just like watching hockey on my TV, but because like no one can really, you know, go to games and stuff, and I think that it will be great when we're able to go to games again. But
I was gonna say the same thing. I was super lucky before everything happened. I got to catch a game with Cammy in Vancouver. I was back visiting my family, and that was like an incredible experience that I would not have had if I wasn't working for this team or just kind of regularly. So that's not usually how I watch hockey, but that was a really cool experience I got because of this.
You don't usually watch hockey with Hall of Famers?
No, it's not usually.
I mean, the three of us do all the time.
Yeah, we do it all the time. Yeah.
But yeah, otherwise it's just on TV with my family. Nothing really super different about how we're watching. I think it's a little bit more interesting. We're paying a little bit more attention to third liners, I think. Like that might be the most interesting thing.
So Danny, that's a great point. I mean, it is funny how sort of our kind of mandate for the expansion draft and the types of players we will not be able to target definitely influences how we watch the games on our TVs in terms of who we're really focusing on and trying to figure out which players, you know, might not necessarily be lighting it up, but could they light it up in a different situation if they were not a depth player on their team, but you know, had more responsibility on our team. I think some really interesting discussions already just by watching the playoffs and kind of talking about that.
And I, you know, right now, I know you would say, oh, it's too early. You can't really kind of say who, and I know you can't talk about names, but you can certainly like circle three or four players almost per team that that could be in the mix. And so do you end up like watching their shifts a little bit closer than you would say a random throwaway game in February?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, we've definitely flagged players of interest. I feel like we can say that. So that's just a
can you give me names? Just
email it to us later.
We'll, yeah.
We'll share it.
If you're keeping an eye on Thatcher Demko, blink twice. All right. No, no, we won't say. We won't say if she blinked or not.
So about the technology, can you give me some insight on like the tools that you're using? You don't have to name names, but there are suppliers out there of data, right? Of different amateur leagues and pro leagues in Europe and, well, even North America for that matter. Can you give us a little insight of the spectrum of kind of hockey analytics?
Sure. So, you know, as you mentioned, there are a bunch of different data providers. You know, we have a few already, but that's also a big thing that we're doing at this point as we're kind of building up our department is to continue to talk to data providers to sort of see, especially when you're talking about junior leagues and when you're talking about overseas leagues, you know, we don't just want to know kind of goals, assists, and like penalty minutes or whatever you can get in terms of like box score stats. Like we,
but
we
plus
like,
minus you care about, right? Plus minus you care about.
Well, all else. Yeah, no. but as much as we can, we would love to get this, the kind of robust data that we can get for the NHL, not even just the tracking stuff, but you know, the NHL play-by-play is very rich in terms of just having, you know, all the shifts players are taking, and all sorts of other sort of data points that we can then use to generate interesting stats. And as much as we would be able to do that for overseas leagues and junior leagues, that would be great. So we're definitely continuing to look into that. And then, yeah, I think that's another really interesting part of our job is just trying to figure out, you know, what can we do with the data that's available to us? What can we say, not just about NHL players, but especially about like amateur players or players overseas? You know, we'll definitely be working on all facets of that.
And I think so some of the other interesting tech that John and Eric use on the developer and data engineering side, there's a lot of stuff that's a lot of cloud technology to build out databases and stuff like that. And honestly, like, I don't even understand a lot of the tools that John uses. He's really good at his job, but there's a lot that he does do in the cloud to kind of make data accessible to us and make it all link together really nicely. And then also kind of in terms of the technical tools we use, RStudio and R, although there is some Python, and if Alex was on here, she would call that out as well.
Alex would? Alex is the Python fan, right? You two are the R fans. Okay.
Yeah. I'm someone who does a lot, who has done a lot of coverage of junior hockey. How can I get my hands on those better information? We just got individual shots in the Western Hockey League, and it's pretty sketchy at times. I remember a player had two goals, but only had one shot registered on the score sheet. So it's
sounds amazing.
Pick that guy up.
He's already been drafted. Sorry, but I've resorted to like with chicken scratches, taking shot attempts at 5-on-5 just on a notebook at the game. That's what I've resorted to. But I would love to just have a place I could look that up. Is that something that's ever coming, do you think?
I mean, I hope so. And you know, one thing is like with a lot of sort of data companies, you know, they'll have video tracking, which is how they get events, things like that. Like, I think maybe the sort of most amazing ideal world we could live in is if every sort of major league had the player and puck tracking that the NHL is going to get. So, you know, I think one thing to aspire to is to hope that that whole system and implementation goes well for the NHL over the next few years and causes other leagues to follow suit. I think that would really be kind of the best case scenario.
Just off like the two goals off one shot, like it's interesting when you get these data sources and you start linking them together and how one data source might classify a shot versus another. And, you know, and it doesn't actually always link perfectly. And so there is like a lot of disagreement sometimes, even between the NHL stuff.
And it could be the same game, right? That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's like,
you can have, and then you watch it, then you pull up the video and it's like, well, he kind of fanned on that shot. And so this is why you can kind of figure out why they labeled or gave it to somebody else. Sometimes there's shots from like the other team You shot the puck at one night, but it credits it to the other team because it bounced off them and stuff. So there's all sorts of things that
it's not all very glamorous deciding which players are good. Like, we've definitely had spirited debates on like whether something was a shot or a pass. So
yeah, that sounds scalable.
And there's individual biases that are at play too, right? Because like, I know depending on what building you're in, right? Like, it'll look like a team has a million shots, and then the following night they come in and play the exact same way and have half as many shots, and they're just in a different building. And yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of stuff to kind of sift through there and try to figure out what's accurate and what's not.
You know, even though we do have reliable data providers, like, nothing is ever perfect. So it does require analysts to really go through and get familiar with the data. I think, you know, that's always something that I tell, you know, aspiring analysts, that like, it's not the most fun part of the job, but you have to like kind of get your hands dirty, understand what's going on in your data. And that includes even just like watching plays if it doesn't make sense what happened in the box score. So, you know, that's all part of it.
Yeah. And honestly, a lot of the time it doesn't seem like it makes sense in the box score. And then you watch the play and you're like, wow, what a weird thing to happen in hockey. Like, there's so many weird things that happen. Yeah.
From the outside looking in, it feels like the Kraken are really prioritizing and investing in analytics and building out those data infrastructures. How does that feel for you guys? Does that sound like a good observation? And how does that compare to the size of the infrastructure that other teams in the NHL might have?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And honestly, one of the reasons that I even decided to move across the country eventually to join the Seattle Kraken is, you know, it was so clear to me that they were going to value the work that me and Danny do. So, you know, it's definitely fair to say that. And I think at least in terms of staffers that are visible publicly, I think our team already has one of the biggest R&D departments in the NHL, which is great. I think that it'll be great for us moving forward. And one thing I always like to say is that, you know, it's not just a matter of us deciding, you know, every player that we're going to take or any of that. Like, a lot of the stuff that we can do is helpful for scouts, is helpful for our GM and all of that, in terms of just making information that everyone needs readily available. Whether it's like stuff like our ratings, to just more simple descriptive stuff like, you know, where did this team take their shots in yesterday's game? Was this guy playing wing or center more here? Like, some of these sort of really descriptive questions are also, I think, important to answer for everyone in hockey ops. And having the R&D department and being as big as it is already, you know, we can just make everyone else's lives easier. So, you know, they don't have to like scramble to answer these types of descriptive questions, and they just have all of that information at their fingertips.
So I know Andy asked a little bit about the WHL specifically, but last year John pulled some data of his own here to determine that there were 33 different amateur leagues from which players were drafted into the NHL. So how do you stitch all that together? I wonder, like, because those don't line up in a lot of cases either. Like, how a guy scores in the WHL is very different from how somebody scores in the NCAA, for example.
I am working on many things trying to answer that question. Alec would probably put a hit out on me if I said anything more specific than that, but trust me when I say that that is a very good question. It is something that we are definitely going to try to answer. And, you know, I love the just amateur draft enthusiasm here in general, because like, that's not only one of my sort of pet interests, it's also like, as much attention as there is on the expansion draft next year, like, we're also going to be drafting in the amateur draft for the first time. And, you know, that's also a big piece of kind of what we're working on. And what I think is cool is, you know, I'm building up some metrics to kind of do a little like test run for this draft next month, kind of showcasing kind of what sorts of metrics we would have on prospects. And, you know, it's nice to be able to be prepared so far in advance, even though I'm certainly not done my draft research by any means. But, you know, having this long of a runway before we're actually going to play games, I think, is a really great opportunity for all the research that we're doing.
NCAA has to have just the worst data, right?
I think...
can you confirm or deny?
Well, I don't know, because sometimes, you know, it's even more difficult to get some data from some European leagues, and I think the language barrier can also play into that. So nothing's easy when it comes to amateur data, but, you know, we're trying our best.
And I mean, John is great. So, I mean, that's the other thing, is like, John's doing a lot of the hard work on the on the
not me, your infrastructure guy, right?
Sorry, your infrastructure guy, yeah.
John, you're great too.
I'm sure
John, both Johns right here. Are great. But our John is specifically great for letting us get data to do our job well. So
we love the amateur draft on this podcast too. What challenges? I mean, it's great that you're working on that now, but the upcoming season, amateur season, is unknown. What kind of challenges is that presenting for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, just on a really basic level, I think we're trying to make sure that we have a sort of video vendors that will get us as much video as we can possibly get on, mm-hmm. on prospects, even if, you know, we can't necessarily go out and scout them as our scouts would be used to. So that's a big component of it. And then in terms of the data, I think it's just trying to be really sort of cognizant as to the ways in which, you know, this season is not going to be like any other season that preceded mm-hmm. it. And is there some way that we can adapt our models to account for that? And that's a question that I don't know the answer to. I think we're going to have to see how the season progresses and how different leagues sort of handle these issues. But yeah, I mean, I don't know that anyone can say that they're definitely prepared for it, but, you know, we have, I guess, the luxury of not having to worry about our own players and our own games. So that does, I guess, give us more time to kind of mm-hmm. try to look at all of these issues.
So then kind of related, all these leagues, you know, have different strengths, weaknesses, and different skill levels. And so there's this whole translation from one league to North America. Like, how does 50 goals in the, and I'm using goals as a generic term, 50 goals in the Swedish Elite League transfer to North America? And I know you're not going to tell me how it is, but do you come up with your own models for that? Or is that something more generally accepted kind of in the analytics community already? Because there seems to be a lot in the public sphere about that.
So that's a great question. And I think, you know, it's not just applicable to our amateur modeling, although it definitely is, but with all of our models, like there's all sorts of ratings models out there for NHL players. There's also sorts of translation factors. There's all types of models that people have already sort of looked into. And what I think is true about statistical modeling is that if you kind of dig deeper into that, if you read everyone's write-ups, if you sort of really dig down into, okay, what are the steps that this analyst took to get to their model? There's all sorts of decisions that are being made in terms of like which players to include and which types of models to use. And all of these sorts of decisions can come up with a model that would, you know, be dramatically different from something that me and Danny might try to conceptualize. So that's where I think, like, I would never say that like the stuff that we're doing is like completely polar opposite to the public. I think, you know, there's definitely some similarities, but there's also, you know, some decisions that we've made in terms of our modeling that we know that the public analysts have not made. And that's really, you know, where that trying to, I guess, justify our jobs is because in addition to having sort of, I guess, the more of resources and data available at an NHL team, we're also trying to sort of make the best modeling decision to get at the results that we want from our models. So hopefully that made sense. Yeah, that's where I would say that even if we do a similar type of model that may be available in the public, you know, some of the decisions that we make along the way are probably going to be different. And that's going to give you a little bit of a different end result as well.
Hey, one quick PSA, just in case you guys have DJ Chark, he's actually out with an injury. I just got an update from Yahoo that I had him in my lineup. And so it's all fixed now, but just wanted to let you guys know.
I'm starting Chenault tonight.
Oh!
So
I drafted him and dropped him and someone else picked him up and I'm kind of pissed because I have no receivers. So,
you know, we're talking a lot about the draft.
The fantasy football draft.
I don't know what you can share, but what do you think is a good draft for an NHL draft? Because I think a lot of listener or new fans or even kind of casual fans don't realize that. I mean, for example, Vegas still has not had one of their draft picks play in a playoff game or really play a full season for them. We know Suzuki's in Montreal, but, you know, there's such a long approach. Like, what is a good draft to you?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think you're alluding to one of the real challenges of evaluating drafts after the fact is that you really have to wait like at least like 5 years, let's say, to even get a sense of like what those players turn out to be. So that's what makes it really challenging. But in terms of, I think, general sort of strategies that I think are good, I think when you look at the draft as a whole, something like half of the players are never even going to play an NHL game. Let's say plus or minus 10% on that. I can't remember the exact stat. But when that's the case, I think when you get to later rounds, you know, what I like to see is, and what I would like to see our team do is really focus on upside in terms of picks. Mm-hmm. Because when you get to later rounds, you know, you're definitely going to be not going to see a lot of players who are sort of like a sure bet to make the NHL. Otherwise they would have been drafted earlier. But what I hope to see then is like that we're not just going to draft someone who is supposed to fill like a fourth line role and that's all they can ever aspire to. You know, I think I would prefer to see more high upside picks where maybe they don't have a huge chance of making it, but if they did, they could be, you know, like a top six or something like that. I think those are the types of decisions that I would want to see in the draft itself. And that's not to say that, you know, bottom six guys aren't valuable, but just, you know, they're a bit easier to find, I think, in free agency and in other contexts.
So, Danny, I've got a tough one for you. Can you explain how math works to Darren and why certain coaches would pull their goalie at different times?
Yeah. Well, that was unfair, John. That was very unfair.
I think this is actually a really common theme, and you can kind of see it across sports and in football with fourth down decision making. I actually wrote my master's thesis for basketball in managing foul trouble. And I think pulling the goalie is somewhere where you get into a negative feedback loop. And so coaches who are already going to probably lose, when they pull their goalie, things look worse if things don't go well. And so they get into a negative feedback loop and they don't do it early enough. So, I mean, the math is like, if you're likely to lose, we want to kind of increase the variance on what happens. We want to make more goals happen. So the best way to do that is to get another skater on the ice. And I think we saw that in the Toronto Columbus series, they scored 3, mm-hmm. right? The only way that happens is if you pull your goalie. And so, yeah, there's a chance that you might get scored against and you might lose by 6 or something, or by 4 or 5, depending on where you're pulling your goalie. But, you were going to probably lose anyways. And so the only way to increase the variance in that game and to increase scoring in that game is to get your goalie out of the net and try to get some lucky things to happen for you.
So I don't think I ever have an issue with it. And I'm a, you know, a noted eyeball test man myself. So I don't have any kind of data to back up my arguments here by any means. But I think my issue with like the early goalie pull doesn't necessarily come when it's like a 2 or 3 goal game, but when it's like a 1 goal game and you see the goalie come out with like 4 minutes left and then they immediately get scored on. And you're like, well, you don't, in my opinion, I feel like you're taking away an opportunity for the players on the ice to get themselves back in the game. Like I feel like you lose 3 minutes of time there, and I'm sure you guys have data to totally thwart my opinion here, but you could have 3 more minutes essentially of a 1-goal game, and instead you immediately get scored on, and it's a 2-goal game, right? That's how I view it, and I feel like that's how it tends to work out more often than not. But I'd love to hear you debunk my theory on that
with all your data.
Yeah,
with all your data, Darren.
Oh yeah. Well, I have a lot of visual data. Let me tell you.
So I haven't run anything myself. I don't know if Namita has a better explanation than me. I know Megan Hall has some great public stuff up there.
What I would just say is, and I think Danny, you've already hit on it, is that even in that sort of 1-goal, like 4-minute left situation, you are probably going to lose anyway. It may feel mm-hmm. like you have more of a chance just because, you know, in hockey, anything can happen and all of that, but your win probability is still very, very low. And so you still actually kind of want to do that high variance risky move of pulling the goalie. It just obviously, as you mentioned, feels worse when you do that. And then immediately you get scored on. I mean, again, Danny mentioned the fourth down stuff as well. I mean, there's so many similarities there. Going for a very high leverage fourth down and then not making it just feels so much worse than if you're a coward and kick or whatever. So trying to move everyone beyond that mindset as much as we can is something that across sports we think would be really great. And I think you're already seeing that in the NFL, shifting that in hockey as well.
There's a great example from last week, the Cowboys going for 2. And mm-hmm. if they missed it, so the whole argument against it from the eye test people are like, well, it feels like you're out of it. Like it's demoralizing. And like, let's get feeling out of it. Like what gives you the best chance to win the game? I don't care if I lose by 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 goals. If it gives me a better chance to win, then I'm doing it. I don't care what the end result is in my loss.
I hate how much sense that makes. When you guys watch sporting events in general, do you ever find yourselves like just screaming at a coach for the decisions that they're making? Like, let's say, you know, Namita, let's say you're watching the Eagles, for example, right? And they're, you know, they're not going for it on fourth down when you think they should, and vice versa. Like, how passionate do you get when you're watching sports? This is, I mean, really for both of you, right? Like, you know, when you're watching something and the coach is obviously doing something that's the opposite of what you think they should do based on data.
I think I actually get more upset, like, not when a team something does something suboptimal, but when a broadcaster says that it's because what I want, I think, is for, especially for like football, which I don't work in anymore, and I wouldn't say I have a strong sense of fandom, even though I love to watch it every week. What I really want is for this sort of general discourse around sports to be a bit more data driven. That's not to say everyone has to pull out their own spreadsheet, but I think just being aware of where coaches or anyone sort of has historically made suboptimal decisions, but you know, this is the answer that people think or have shown is more valuable moving forward. Like I would just love to see kind of more discourse about that rather than just, you know, broadcasters and everyone else who covers any of the sports that I watch sort of relying on just being like, well, he's the coach, he knows best, end of story. Like I think we sort of owe fans the having more fruitful discussions about all of these things and not just saying like everything that happened in the game was perfect and no one can criticize anything because you haven't played the game or whatever.
I don't know. When I watch basketball, I get mad when coaches take their players out when they think they're in foul trouble. And that was, again, what my master's research was in. But my younger brother reminds me every time that I did the same thing to him when I coached his grade 9 basketball team, so that I really have no say. So yeah, I mean, like, I think as long as I think Namita had a great answer that, you know, I love for us to start kind of learning and pushing forward the discourse. I find myself cheering for like the analytically right move. Like, not that I have any allegiances to anyone other than the Kraken in the NHL, but when teams pulled their goalie earlier, I cheered for that. I hope that good things happen to them because, you know, it's exciting. And when teams go for it on fourth down, same type of thing. So I find myself cheering for those moves and hoping they work out, just to kind of, you know, have that in our back pocket. But, you know,
did you guys see the stuff from The Athletic this week? Dom Luchushkin. I know that I'm pretty sure I pronounced that right, that he submitted, you know, his awards ballot, and he did it all on sort of more of an analytical approach from like the normal, whatever, this guy looks good at this thing and he's obviously a defensive forward, so he should be the Selke. And, you know, like one of the things was that he didn't include Leon Draisaitl, John Carlson, or Sean Couturier. Two of them won their awards and the other one finished second, right? And he didn't even put them on his ballot. And so it seemed like a lot of people were like giving him weird backlash on that just because he like didn't go with the flow. I was wondering if you guys had any thoughts on how that all shook out.
I have a lot of thoughts, but I will try to keep them sort of appropriate for public distribution. I think, so first and foremost, I think if fans just want awards ballots that all say the same thing, then what are we even doing, right? Like, why are we having everyone submit their own if fans just want one list? That everyone agrees on, air quotes around agrees. And then the other thing that I will say is that, I mean, I'm interested in if people with scouting perspectives talk about their player evaluations through that lens. And I'm interested in when analysts talk about their player evaluations through their models that they try to make as robust and as comprehensive as possible in terms of evaluating all facets of the game. What I'm not interested in is arguments like, oh, he had the most points, therefore he must be the best. Like, I think, you know, that's something that I really don't see much value in, or I don't think that it's worth sort of voting on something if all you're going to do is adhere to just sort of one box score stat or something like that. And that has nothing to do with who I think should have won any of the awards. Like, it might be the case that whoever had the most points was the most valuable. I don't know that I would ever sort of use that as a reasoning behind my sort of pick. And also, I think when you talk to scouts, you know, who really watch a ton of hockey, you would hope that they don't just lean on having the most points, that they have more, I think, descriptive things to say about how players play and really what makes them so lethal on the ice.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think if your argument back to Dom is your dumb points, then like you're choosing a worse stat. Like, and you're not even addressing his argument, which was that defense is important too. Now, if you come back and you say, oh, I watched him play defense and I actually think he did a really good job, and here's where he did a good job and here's how he did a good job, and I think that it's not showing up an impact for in the impact results for this reason, that's a really well put together argument. And that's something that, you know, some of the models might miss on because they're not watching technique. They're not watching stuff. They're looking at impact and they're trying to account for your teammates and your competition. But, you know, if you have like real kind of evidence that isn't included in the model, then yeah, there can be a disagreement. But if you're just going to say, no, Dom, you're dumb, points, 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 then you're choosing a worse stat to die on. I think it was great that he had his own take. He argued for it. He supported it with evidence. And I think if you're going to do that, then you would hopefully get some nice discourse back. But that's, I don't really think what happened.
Yeah. And again, this has nothing to do with our own personal opinions on who should win which awards, but it has everything to do with, again, I think this goes back to my earlier point about like, we just want, among other things, the discourse to be better for everyone. You know, we think that it's a worthwhile thing for you to vote how you believe you should vote rather than just how you believe everyone else is going to vote. So that's something that I think we definitely respect.
Blink twice if you thought Leon Draisaitl should have won.
I'm turning around okay. Now.
She goes off video.
His argument was really fascinating to me, and not specifically about Draisaitl, but that whole offense versus how they play in their own end discussion. It's always weird to me because I know Ovechkin's had some similar seasons. I remember a season Kovalchuk had way back in Atlanta where he put up great numbers, but you're going to cringe when I use this step. He had like a minus 60 on his plus minus, which, yeah. So where is there a threshold when you guys look at just in general a player? Like, when does that defense become a liability where it overcomes how much he's producing offensively?
I mean, it's not so much a threshold as just like in our models, you know, we try to capture offensive output, we try to capture defensive output, and then we do see like, does it cancel each other out? Mm-hmm. And on the flip side, I think, you know, something our models do identify that is also pretty interesting is like players who seem to have really good defensive impacts, but, you know, people don't talk about as much. And I think those are also very interesting players where just because defense isn't as flashy, but we can still say that they're having a great impact on their team. Those are also some types of players that we like to highlight and look at more closely because, again, not as flashy, but still potentially really valuable.
Yeah, I think you always want more goals for us than goals for the other team. And so like, as long the bigger that difference is, the better, and the smaller that difference is, especially if it's going negative, the worse it is. But also like, I think like people notice offense, and so people kind of value offense. And so like, in other people's heads, that equation might be different. I want to just, you know, win the game. But if you care about offense more, then that's something that you value. And maybe that goes into MVP. Maybe that goes into most valuable to you. So
I'm just making a note here. More goals for us, less goals
is better
for them. Yeah. Got it. Okay.
That's math.
When
that was Dom's argument.
When Danny told me that, I was blown away. I was like, oh my God, I feel all wrong.
So advanced.
This is what happens when you come from basketball. It's you bring these lessons you learn.
The work you guys are doing now, obviously, a lot of focus on the expansion draft, as you mentioned, as well as the amateur draft. But with the expansion draft, obviously the rosters are going to change a lot between now and when you guys pick. You have the free agency, you have a trade deadline coming up. How does that affect you guys? Like, how do you account for that? Do you target some players, or are you just looking at more general, gathering as much information as you can on as many players as you can?
The nice thing for us is that like when we do ratings, like we evaluate everyone. So the thing where we really don't want to miss is we don't want anyone to fall through the cracks that the scouts haven't seen, right? We want to have their opinion. We want to make sure that they see everyone mm-hmm. that's of interest. And so, you know, we get a rating on everyone. And then we kind of want to make sure that throughout the season that no one falls through the cracks.
So a lot of what we do is just sort of having lists of players and highlighting who we think is interesting from an analytical perspective and sort of saying like, keep an eye on this guy, let us know what you think. And that generates some really interesting discussions. Another thing I would say is, even though the specific rosters and everything are going to change, I think it's really useful for us to sort of constantly be in the mindset of like, if the draft was today, what would we do? And kind of going through those types of exercises, because it's something that you really have to get used to. And, you know, we're going to have such a small window of time to actually do this that we have to be as prepared as possible, you know, before we get those protection lists. So that's where, like, even though that's a while away, even though the rosters are going to look a lot different, getting into the habit of trying to make those decisions constantly, I think will only help us down the road.
All right. Well, this has been interesting and informative, and I'm excited to, you know, learn through your blinks who we should expect to see on the Kraken. Namita and Danny, thank you so much for doing this. This has been fun, and best of luck to you. I know you're going to be put together a great team for us. So
it's on you. Yeah, it's on you too. I'll remember that.
thanks so much for having us, guys.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun.
All right, thank you again to Namita and Danny. I think that was a lot of fun, and we very much appreciate the Seattle Kraken for letting us chat with them.
That was a fun conversation. And Danny, I want to quick call out to Danny that he's come out and helped out with the Learn to Play for some of the kids that I coach. And so cool. I appreciate that. If Danny's probably not listening, but I've he doesn't want to hear himself.
Listen, if Doc Emmerich is listening, then Danny is certainly listening.
I thought they pump our podcast into the Kraken offices.
Well, it's going to be part of the goal song. They're just going to play the podcast.
We now move on to our segments, and it is with great pride that I bring you our first segment, which is everyone's favorite segment,
Goalie
Gear
person.
Corner.
Maybe not one
person.
Did I
do that right? I don't know. I'm all frazzled now. Anyway, our first Goalie Gear Corner comes from Goalie Gear Nerd, who very frequently brings us Goalie Gear for Goalie Gear Corner. This is from the BCHL's Victoria Grizzlies, and the goalie is Justin Easter. These are funky. They look like they're furry. Wow. They're Bauer pads.
Love it.
So the obviously grizzlies. So it looks like grizzly fur. It's very very interesting.
With stripes.
I like it.
Neat. I think it would be better if they put actual fur on it, but that's just me.
I don't know.
And then our other Goalie Gear Corner, shout out to listener of the pod, Lisa Martin, who often will send me some tips. She sent me another Bauer setup. This is from the equipment room at Notre Dame. So these are the new setup for their goalie there. So it's a printed image of the Golden Dome building, whatever that's called at Notre Dame. And then on the glove and blocker, it's got the same. And then there's a little subtle touchdown Jesus kind of in the background above the Golden Dome building, which I think is pretty nice. Very solid color scheme, obviously, and just a good, clean, but also creative look. So well done, Notre Dame and Bauer Hockey. John, your thoughts? Cool. We now move on to You Don't See That Every Day. You really don't see this every day, so I don't know
not.
If you guys saw
I do not want to see this every day.
Resurfacer that went up in a fiery, blaze of glory. I have a lot of questions on this. I want to know how it happened. I want to know what the red stuff was that was leaking out of the back. I still don't know if we have those answers. I'm also very curious as to how the driver thought it was the right decision to actually drive back into the garage while the thing was burning. Fascinating chain of events. Something like we've never seen before.
Yeah, he stayed on it while the flames were all around him. He was pretty close to that fire.
He's a gamer. So the
he's a hockey guy.
The fluid is transmission fluid, and that tends to happen with Zambonis. But so it wasn't blood, if that's what you're kind of thinking.
I didn't think that the Zamboni was bleeding, but I was curious as to what that liquid was. So thank you for clarifying that. On the topic of clarifying things, the Zamboni company had a tweet about this. It said, "There have been numerous improper references to Zamboni in connection with an unfortunate incident in Rochester, New York on Wednesday, October 14th. The machine seen on fire in the videos, which were shared online, was not manufactured by the Zamboni company."
Yeah, I think it's funny. We all just assume that's a Zamboni, but there are different manufacturers, and Zamboni's a brand name.
Right, right. Well, this is like Band-Aid, right, or Kleenex. Like, get me a Kleenex. No, get me a Zamboni. It's going to be an ice resurfacer. It doesn't matter what brand it is. We're going to call it a Zamboni, right? But yeah, I think it was an Olympia, I believe. Olympia which, what is it, like a subpar Zamboni or what? But
apparently, it caught on fire. Manufacturer was.
Low-end resurfacer, mm-hmm, Darren.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I actually remember when my rink got a new ice resurfacer when I was growing up. They replaced an old Zamboni with an Olympia machine, and I remember people looking at it and being like, "Ooh, look at that hot rod over there. That's pretty sick."
Did it ever catch on fire?
Not that I saw. Zamboni says, "We appreciate the numerous posts by members of the public where they have taken the opportunity to point out that it was not a Zamboni brand ice resurfacer, illustrating the awareness that the use of the brand name Zamboni as a generic product descriptor is incorrect." So, which I think is odd. Like, that's an odd stance, right? Like, if I'm a brand, I'm going to go listen to a Sound of Hockey, right? And that just means you're going to go listen to a podcast, right? Like, I'd be kind of proud of that if that was like the legacy that we were going to leave, you know?
Yeah, but not if there was like engulfed in flames
and a major malfunction.
Amongst the children on the ice.
I mean, if your Band-Aid catches on fire and it's not an actual Band-Aid brand, they wouldn't bandage, like, you know, whatever. Anyway, you don't see that every day. We now move on to our weekly one-timers. Our first weekly one-timer. The QMJHL has hit pause for its Quebec-based teams, not off to a great start as far as COVID goes.
No, they started before the other CHL leagues, way before, and they've had to now shut down the Quebec, you know, the Quebec division, if we want to call it that. The Maritimes are still playing, but Quebec has had a big outburst of COVID cases as a province, and that's affected the teams. There's been multiple positive cases, so now they're kind of taking a step back and getting that under control before they continue.
And while they are pausing, we also have some return information from the WHL. So when is the WHL coming back?
Yeah, January 8th. They announced this last week that January 8th will be their start date. And the interesting that they're calling it a firm start date, not a target date. And, you know, before we talked about they originally they couldn't play unless they had 50% attendance in each building. But now they're going away from that. They're going to start on that date, the 8th, whether there's fans allowed or not in each individual jurisdiction. So they're moving forward. It's going to be a division play only. So the teams here locally are only going to play the U.S. division teams. No word yet on how many games. They have a May 2nd end date. So they say it's a maximum of 50, but they haven't determined that yet. They say it'll be mid-November when we hear the scheduling plan. And they're not even sure what they're going to do with the playoffs. That's also to be determined.
Yeah, college hockey also returning. Big Ten has said they're going to start November 13th. And the NCHC says that they're going to return November 1st. So we shall see there. Hopefully we have hockey coming back at different levels. And, you know, hopefully the NHL figures it out too. And we have hockey again soon.
Did we ever talk about the Big Ten adding ASU this season? Arizona State?
I don't think we have.
It was kind of subtle and flew under the radar. It's just for the season. But who knows? It could be more of a long-term thing too. So...
I mean, it makes the most sense if they're going to join a conference, you know, other than, I guess, maybe the NCHC, you could see that working out geographically. Yeah. But I think the Big Ten does make the most sense. It's just odd because, like, the ASU is not a Big Ten school, and all the schools that are in the Big Ten Hockey Conference, I guess with the exception of Notre Dame, right, which is independent in the other sports, right? Mm-hmm. It's odd, but I can see it happening. I think you might be onto something there, so we'll see. Our next weekly one-timer, Megan Duggan has retired after 14 years, 3 Olympics, 2 silver medals, and 1 gold medal. Pretty good.
Decent.
Yeah, and she was the captain of the 2018 Winter Olympics when they won the gold medal in Pyeongchang. And she also captured 7 gold medals in world championships. That's a lot of gold medals. A
lot of gold medals.
And do you know where she played college?
Wisconsin.
Darren? That's right.
Sorry.
Not Darren.
Okay. Thank you, Andy.
Real quick, she was also very influential in the 2017 boycott that the U.S. women's team did during the world championship to get more equitable benefits from USA Hockey. And it created a lot of change and moving in the right direction for women. And she was part of that leadership group. And like I said, she was in the captain the following year for the Winter Olympic team. So pretty influential person. It sounds like she's going to stay around the sport. So we're hoping, we see more of her now.
Yeah, very cool. Congratulations, Megan, on a great career. And I'm sure you're listening. Our final weekly one-timer. The World Junior Championship schedule is out. I think most notably, we can expect the United States to play Team Russia on December 25th, Christmas night. That'll be awesome. I'm looking forward to that. I saw Bobby Margarita with a good thread of tweets today answering a lot of questions that are out there. So look that up if you're at all interested. Most notably, he was kind of commenting on the fact that there are some NHL players, right, that played in the NHL last year, like Kaapo Kakko and Jack Hughes and Kirby Dach, who technically are eligible to play. NHL could, in theory, not be playing yet when this starts. Mm-hmm. But Bobby Margarita indicated that he doesn't think any of those players will actually end up playing just because they'll most likely be in NHL training camp.
But you could see guys like Lafreniere go, and I mean, we can see if those guys go or not. They're still eligible as well.
You could, in theory, which would make it a very, very different tournament and a very interesting tournament. So,
and they're basically following the same protocols that the NHL used for the bubble, the playoffs. It's the same building, same hotels, all the same things, same deal.
Like we said, Edmonton is essentially just a permanent bubble now. So if you want to escape COVID, you can just go check into the city of Edmonton and you'll be fine. We close the show with our tweets of the week. John, what's your tweet of the week?
So it's a two-parter. NHL Nosebleed tweeted, name a NHL player you were convinced would turn out to be a superstar but never panned out. And then John Buchagross, he says, according to the parents of the roster of mites I coached in 2005, all of the kids on that team.
That's pretty good. I actually coached a youth team once as well. I'm sure I've mentioned that. And I remember some of those parents were so wacky and thought their kid was so great. And I actually remember like the head of the program very distinctly this one evening. He's like, I don't know, the kid's dad is a fucking lunatic. Just whatever. Just sign them all up for the NHL right now. he was just over it. So funny. So funny. Andy, your tweet of the week?
My tweet of the week comes from, and I hope I'm getting this name right, at Darren Funbrown.
Okay.
I think that's the name.
That sounds like a lunatic.
And this Darren person is responding to a tweet from College Hockey Inc. They tweeted out, what would scouts write about you? And so Darren responded, tries hard. What he lacks in size, he also lacks in skill. Mostly annoying presence in the dressing room, but occasionally gets a few laughs. Hockey IQ very much on the charts. So I thought that was pretty good.
Who wrote that?
I love that. I love that one.
Someone named Darren Fun Brown.
Mm-hmm. I'm proud that you used my tweet as a tweet of the week. That's that brought a tear to my eye. I appreciate it. I did not expect it. I very much appreciate the support there. My tweet You're of the welcome. Week comes from at Sarah Sivian. She says, my boyfriend is reffing men's hockey league games and I'm at the brewery across the street, and one of the guys playing there later is at the brewery, and I told him to loudly keep talking about this hot girl he saw at the brewery. Let's see how it goes. And then she sent an update. It says, update, he didn't care. That was pretty good. She's a pretty good follow. I really enjoy what she does on Twitter. So anyway, that wraps up our show. Episode 109, the Doc Emmerich episode. Thank you again to Namita Nandakumar and Danny Chu for joining us, and to the Seattle Kraken for allowing them to join us. Please do subscribe on iTunes, subscribe on Stitcher, subscribe on Spotify. Leave your 5-star review on iTunes, just as Al Robbins did, except please be nicer to me with your 5-star review.
No, that was beautiful.
But no matter what you write, we will read it. As long as it's a 5-star review, we will read it on our show. So we've always held up to that. We will do so. We will talk to you all next week for episode 110. Cheers. Well,